Yeah, I know. It's quite Yasin, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about it.
Yeah,
so you can ask
that question. Anyway, over the last week and a half, we were talking about the egg donors and surrogacy. And really what we did last week is we brought a whole list of different sources, which we concluded with last week. Different sources and on both sides of the coin, as we saw that there's this halachic argument of who is the mother. And who is the mother is more important than the question with artificial insemination of who is the father, because or whether fatherhood is carried by insemination, just like that. Because over here there's a question of Jewish identity as well. So we saw different arguments, different sides of the coin, and of course this is something which, unlike artificial insemination, is not mentioned anywhere. It's something which is totally, totally new. What the rabbis have to do is try to find similar cases in the Talmud, similar cases which they're able to extrapolate on and able to say, well, this is similar. And of course, we have people on the other side of the coin saying, well, it's not similar, it's totally different. And that leads to the major argument, the discussion, the way it is today. So where we stand now is, we discussed also ideas of going to the mikveh and a couple of things to do with that as well. Where does modern-day halacha stand on it? And in the last week, I also consulted with a particular rabbi in Israel, who is an expert. He's part of a institute which deals with these things, to try and get an idea of where they stand on it. And the answer is actually that it's one of those very, very grey areas of halacha. It's not very, very clear. But I'll tell you whatever I know, as clear as it is. Obviously, what we've discussed is only the tip of the iceberg. It's only a tiny, tiny drop of how deep the discussion actually goes, because there's many sides to it. What's very important is that to realize every single situation is absolutely unique. Every single situation has to be dealt with on a case-by-case issue, with a doctor, with a rabbi. There's no situation which is similar to another. Every single one is unique. And what you find, this rabbi actually said, what you do find too often is that couples or people have this idea that halacha definitely says that it's a problem, and halacha definitely says that it's out, and they don't even try to seek that possibly there's no problem halachically. And very often, actually, there is no problem. Well, not no problem halachically, but there's ways to get around the problems, ways to work with the issue. Let's first look at the ways dealt with today as a Jewish woman who has a problem with her eggs and she wants to receive from a donor. So she's able to deliver a child. She has no problem with the uterus or anything like that, but she needs to receive eggs from a donor. Although there's no one clear ruling, which is accepted by everyone as to whether the status of the child is based on the egg donor or on the woman carrying the child, the majority view is definitely that the woman carrying the child is the mother, halachically. That's definitely, definitely the majority view. The view that the egg donor is the halachic mother is a minority view, which is taken into account sometimes, as we'll see practically. But the majority view is definitely that it is the mother, it's the woman who carries the child who is the mother. However, because of the other view, because there is this view, which is nevertheless a standpoint in halacha, that the carrier of the eggs, that Judaism, that motherhood is determined genetically, and also because of another factor, and that is, we'll talk about it soon, that the factor when it comes to egg donation, taking an egg from a non-Jew, means that a non-Jew was part and parcel, very much so, in the conception of the child. So therefore, for spiritual purposes, and we'll talk about this more in a moment, the rabbis who permit it, and they obviously do so only if there are other avenues that have been explored and have failed, do so with using the egg of a Jewish donor. That is the foremost. There are, of course, everything is case by case issue. Sometimes it's impossible to get the egg of a Jewish donor, something like that. That will also be explored. But the rabbis, in the first instance, who are going to permit it, not all rabbis permit it. Some rabbis may say the issues are too much to even think of, and therefore, bye-bye. But most of the rabbis who do permit it would do so using the egg of a Jewish donor. On the other hand, because of that issue, that a lot of the, because there are the rabbis who have this idea that the egg donor, that the maternity or that the Judaism is determined by the carrier of the eggs. On the other hand, we're getting to that. On the other hand, the major issue which arises when using the eggs of a Jewish donor is the worry that years down the track, the siblings may marry each other. Which, of course, remember, we're taking into account that the egg donor might be the mother, right? So then, siblings down the track may marry each other, which is, of course, would not be the case if you're using eggs of a non-Jewish donor, because the children would convert, they're not related, and or her other children, her other offspring, would be non-Jewish. So you wouldn't have to worry about them marrying each other. Another critical criteria, as you mentioned correctly, is that the Jewish egg donor obviously be single. Otherwise, what would happen is that, as we discussed before, there's a possible question of adultery, which means that if she's the mother, she would be, well, not the mother because she's not giving birth to the child, but she would be producing a child from another man other than her husband, which is a major question of adultery, and therefore she would have to be a single woman. And of course, it's obvious that she would have to be unrelated to the husband or the wife, to the couple, because otherwise there's the question of incest. You know, there it's like if she is, say, let's say his sister, so he's having a child with his sister, besides for the medical problems which could come about. In Israel, a few years ago, the Knesset passed a law allowing to take eggs from single Jewish mothers. And I'm not sure exactly how it works in all countries. Every country, every state, I know in America, every state has their own laws. But they passed the law allowing for eggs to be taken from single Jewish mothers, as they set up also a special registration system in such a way where a person can, which determines that the donor is unrelated in any way to the couple, and also somehow, I don't understand how the system works, but somehow what comes out through the system is that the couple will not necessarily know who they're getting from, but nevertheless it will avoid the possibility of this child marrying another one of the offspring of the egg donor. That is the way that this registration system has been set up, and it is used by very, very orthodox circles. It's been used by orthodox institutes and by very orthodox people, in fact, to that degree, people who need to have egg donations. Right. Well, the same, a similar issue. Well, when it comes to sperm donation, the issue there is wasting of semen.
Yes.
So the way what they try to do is they try to freeze it or so that can be used at a later stage, so that the man won't have to emit the semen,
yes,
more than once.
Yeah.
Right. That's what. When it comes to egg donations, that itself is not an issue with egg donations. The reason being because there's no such thing as wasting of eggs in halacha. There's a thing of wasting of semen, but there's no such thing as wasting of eggs. There is a thing, maybe, wasting of a fertilized egg that we'll talk about. We've mentioned that before. But wasting an egg itself in halacha doesn't have any place, because halacha actually, interestingly enough, there's nowhere in early sources which talks about the eggs of a woman, talks about the sperm of a man, doesn't talk as the eggs of the woman being part of the reproductive system of producing the child. Talks about that the woman gives part of the child, and the man gives part of the child, and part of the genetics of the child are determined by the woman, but it doesn't talk about, and the man, of course, but it doesn't talk about specifically, it doesn't mention the idea of when it talks about zera, meaning wasting seed, it talks specifically of the man seed. It's interesting to note that there are some early sources that maintain that even if the gestational mother is the halachic mother of the child, this is what we said before, even if the gestational mother is 100% the halachic mother of the child, if the eggs came from someone else, from a non-Jew, the child would still require some sort of conversion. Would require conversion. Why so? You're saying that the mother of the child is the mother who gave birth to the child. So why so? Why would you need to have a conversion just because the egg donor, who is not the mother of the child, that doesn't carry the Jewish part of the child, so to say, why would you need conversion? And here's a very interesting point some people may not know. In the commentary point out that there are two forms of conversion. Usually, these two forms of conversion take place at once, and that's why we're unaware that there actually are two things which are happening in conversion. What are the two points of conversion? The words are, there's conversion for the purpose of becoming a Jew, which means the purpose of becoming a member of Israel, a member of the Jewish nation. And then there's a conversion for the purpose of acquiring the sanctity of the Jewish people. So think about it for a second. Usually it's the exact same thing. Person converts, non-Jewish person converts, so they get both at once. At the same time that they become a member of the community of the Jewish people, they also acquire the sanctity of the Jewish people. However, we do see a time in history, and that was at the giving of the Torah, and this is what the commentaries point out, that the Jewish people needed to undergo conversion, and in fact most of the laws of modern-day conversion, which are a conversion the way it's done today, is all based on the way that it was done before the Torah was given. It says that the Jewish people went to the mikveh, and the Jewish people brought a sacrifice, and that's why a person who converted at the time of the temple would have to bring a sacrifice as well. And so to many of the other details are based on that conversion which happened at the giving of the Torah. So there are those who suggest, the way that it worked over there, that normal conversion to become a member of the Jewish community, meaning the first stage, the first idea of conversion, was not necessary at all by the giving of the Torah. Why? Because they were all children of Abraham anyway, and automatically they were part of the community of Israel. They were part of the Jewish community. However, the second stage of conversion, the idea of conversion to acquire the sanctity of a Jew, so that they needed to undergo, in order to become the chosen nation, in order to acquire the sanctity of the Jewish people, to get that extra sanctity, so that's what happened at the giving of the Torah. So they say, they break it down. So basically, conversion today, there are two things which happen. The person becomes Jewish and also acquires the sanctity of a Jew. Usually it's all one and the same. However, we do see a time in history, there was the giving of the Torah, where some of the commentaries say that we actually only needed to undergo conversion to acquire the one part of conversion, to become sanctified, to acquire the sanctity of the Jewish people, but not to become part of the Jewish nation, because who was the Jewish nation other than the children of Abraham? And those are the ones who were Jewish. On this basis, there are those who point out, it will follow that an egg from a non-Jewish woman, if a person acquires the egg is born from the egg of a non-Jewish woman, even if we'll say that Judaism, the maternity is determined by the gestational mother, even if we'll say that, since a great part in the formation of a child came from a non-Jewish source, the second purpose of conversion, to acquire the sanctity of Israel, would be required. And therefore, the rabbis should say that even if we're going to say 100%, we'll say with 100% clarity that the mother follows the one who gives birth to the child. Nevertheless, if the eggs came from a non-Jewish donor, then the child would be required to undergo conversion. So let's just sum up with regards to egg donations today. There are differing opinions, because this is a conclusion of a long discussion. Differing opinions. There are rabbis today who will not permit it at all. There are rabbis like that. There are, however, many very prominent authorities. We're not talking about the small rabbis who will give in to anything, who are lenient on everything, but there are many very prominent halakhic authorities who do permit it. As to who is the best donor, who to get the egg from, so then it depends on the three opinions today of how we halakhically define motherhood. Each opinion leads us to a different solution to identifying the optimum egg donor. On the one hand, we say the birth mother, which is definitely the majority opinion, that the birth mother is the mother of the mother of the child. According to this, the child is Jewish depending on the mother, and we don't have to worry whatsoever about where the eggs come from. Then there's a minority opinion, the opinion that it depends on the donor, on the that maternity depends on the donor. According to this, the birth mother's religion is not important, and what matters is where the eggs come from. However, in this case, the husband is fathering a child with another woman because she is the mother, so she must be someone who is not married. She has to be a single woman, otherwise he's having a child with a married woman. And of course, there too you can argue that it's not real adultery because there's no act, as we once discussed.
But the egg could be coming from his wife, and it could be gestating in a surrogate. So therefore, that wouldn't be an issue, would it?
No, but it's his. Yeah, but also we'll get onto surrogacy in a minute. Okay, and then there's a third opinion, and this is the opinion that both the birth mother and the donor mother determine the motherhood, which means, and this is obviously the opinion which is best to follow. According to this opinion, there is doubt as to the definition of motherhood, and we have to be strict both ways, and both the donor mother and the mother delivering the child, the gestational mother, must be Jewish. If only one of them is Jewish, then according to this opinion, you need to have a child needs conversion, which will eliminate any doubt as to the Jewish identity of the child. In order to satisfy all opinions, the best, the optimum donor to use is obviously a single Jewish mother, with obviously going into the, we're talking about into the wife over here, who's a Jewish woman. That is the very best thing to do. Where also that woman would have to be unrelated to either the spouses, and the identity would somehow have to be known in the registration system, at least somehow, that to avoid siblings coming to marry each other. That is the optimum way. Obviously, that's very nice to talk, but it's not always possible. It doesn't always happen that way. And then there are also halachic solutions to that. Are halakhic solutions, but it's more complicated to produce a child, knowing that the child is going to have to undergo conversion, which is with conversion, it depends which way it is, and that's why it's definitely more complicated. Now, with regards to a surrogate mother, where the egg and sperm come from a Jewish couple, here too, there is no absolute halakhic consensus at all. Each case over here must be discussed, has to be looked at individually with an expert rabbi in the field, someone who really knows about these things, how it works medically, how it works halakhically, as there are many, many variable factors. You cannot compare a family who already have a few children to a family, to a couple who are dying to have children, that don't have any children, and their only option is to use a surrogate. There are those who permit this. I'm talking when I say there are those, it's those halachic authorities today who permit under certain exceptional circumstances, and then there are those who will never allow it whatsoever. For many different reasons, a lot of them ethical reasons, a lot of reasons which we share with the non-Jewish world as well, but a lot of them also halachic reasons because of the confusion which can be created. There are those who will never allow it, but there are those, as I said, who definitely under certain exceptional circumstances do allow it. Because it raises the question of adultery, as we discussed when talking about artificial insemination, the semen, we're talking about the semen of a married man entering another woman, and over here it's even worse because she's the one giving birth to the child. So some will never allow it whatsoever. Others, however, in light of the fact that in Torah law, strictly speaking, a man is allowed to have more than one wife. So if a man can marry, can have more than one wife, strictly speaking, remember it's only what's called the Cherem of Rabbeinu Gershom, which means it was an enactment of a great rabbi 1,000 years ago, who said that a man, which was taken on by Ashkenazic Jewry, that a man should not marry more than one woman. But halach, strictly speaking, biblically speaking, a man is allowed to marry more than one woman. So therefore, there are rabbis who allow it in certain extreme circumstances. Providing, of course, that the woman is not married, right? Because if she's not married, so a man can marry a few women, biblically speaking, but of course not if any of them are married. So the surrogate mother would have to be single, because if she's married, receiving the child from another man is very close to the prohibition of adultery. Similarly, the surrogate mother must, of course, not be related to either spouse, and this would raise questions of incest. Now, with regards to should she be Jewish or not Jewish, the surrogate mother, very similar to the discussion to the idea with egg donation. Since the more accepted view is definitely that view that holds that the gestational mother is the real mother, is the halachic mother of the child. Therefore, if a non-Jewish mother were used, a non-Jewish surrogate was used, the child would definitely require to undergo conversion. There's no question about that. And here too, of course, there's the issue. There's those that have the aversion to it in general of a non-Jewish woman carrying the child, because of the four spiritual reasons that for a non-Jewish person being so involved in the birth of a Jewish child. The downside, of course, of having a Jewish surrogate is again that we would have to worry about the possibility of the children later on marrying each other. Whereas if it was a non-Jewish surrogate, if it was a non-Jewish woman who gave birth to the child, you don't have that concern because the child will be converted, and after the child is converted, converts are halachically, strictly speaking, not related to each other. So even though medically it may not be advised, but strictly speaking, we wouldn't have to worry about them marrying each other. Which means like this: with a Jewish surrogate, the procedure cannot be done secretly. Again, it would have to be, as the child needs to know, somehow it has to be clear who the mother is to avoid marrying future offspring of the surrogate, of this woman who gave birth to the child. To those rabbis who permit it, and there are those rabbis who permit it under exceptional circumstances, in very extreme cases, allow it using a Jewish surrogate. To use a non-Jewish is already very, very tricky, and I'll be honest, I don't know if there's any rabbi, any strictly orthodox rabbi who will allow it because of the many, many issues which it brings to.
What are the issues?
You're having a child which is not going to be Jewish, and you want to convert. So we look at it at two different stages. You look at it as being having a non-Jewish child, bring a non-Jewish child into the world, right? Conversion is going to take place afterwards, but it's already too complicated to say that it's totally allowed. Whereas if it's a Jewish mother, then it's a little bit different. And even then, as I said, there are many rabbis who will not allow it at all. Then put it this way: there's much more rabbis who won't allow surrogacy with a Jewish mother than rabbis who won't allow egg donations. Talking with all Jewish, as in the best possible way. Because there, almost the majority, I'd say, of rabbis do allow it today. They're pretty with it. Of course, the best way that it'd be done, the egg donor be a Jewish woman, single, and then they're allowed. So then the question is whether we determine entire motherhood by the birth of the child, by being the one who delivers the child or not. If we say that entirely the one who delivers the child is the mother of the child, so then it doesn't matter if they're not genetically related at all. Although we did point out something interesting, and that you mentioned, we mentioned last week, there is an opinion which holds that even though the mother who gives birth to the child is halachically the mother, but when it comes to matters of determining Jewish identity, that has to go after the egg donor, after the egg. And he says that it makes sense to say that, because us being Jewish has definitely got something to do with our genetics. So we're genetically Jewish people. So he says that even if you're going to determine, this is like a real far off opinion, which I saw, that even if you're going to say that with all halachic matters, that the children, that motherhood is determined by delivery of the child. Nevertheless, to determine Judaism, there has to be only it's a genetic thing, and therefore the egg donor is what determines the Judaism. So in this particular situation, you can have, why am I mentioning this now? Because you can have that they will be either Jewish or non-Jewish, and related or unrelated, it depends. You can have one and not the other. That's what according to that opinion.
And the name. So therefore, if the child's Jewish status and the mother is the birth mother,
yeah,
even though the eggs came from the wife of the husband, then...
Wait, I lost you.
So Mr. and Mrs. X gets a surrogate.
Right.
The surrogate is Jewish.
Right.
And we're saying that halakhically the mother...
Okay.
That is the mother. That is halakhically
right.
The mother.
Okay.
The woman who just stated the egg
right.
Is the mother.
Right, right, right.
But does the child take the name of the woman that just stated or the mother, the wife of the husband?
Oh, well the meaning from the egg thing. Good question. So the question is, why is it important? So let's say we want to call, is this child called Bas, the daughter of that woman? So you're saying Tilim for that person. Is the daughter of that woman, the daughter of that woman,
yeah.
Right? So seemingly, the answer to the question is, although obviously I didn't see this anyway, seemingly it depends on who we say is the Jewish mother. That's what it matters on. It doesn't matter. So if we say that the Jewish mother, as the majority of opinion is, the Jewish mother is the mother who gives birth to the child, so that's how it would be determined.
That could become a difficulty of, you know how we say we never want to embarrass people, or it's one of the foundations of not wanting to embarrass people, then
right.
That person is going to have a...
I mean, I'm going to mention an interesting case soon about that not embarrassing people. But with regards to egg donation itself to an infertile... infertile couple. And by the way, I wish I could say it like really black and white. This is the way it is, and this is the way it is, you know. But unfortunately, anyone, you open any books anyway, you'll see it is definitely amongst strictly Orthodox, that's the approach that we're giving. It's a grey area. But as clear as that could possibly be, the rabbis who, when it comes to egg donation, because that's the bigger one, definitely, when it comes to egg donation, to use in order to cover all bases, there are many rabbis, prominent authorities, who allow it definitely to use from a single Jewish mother, and where somehow the identity is known, she's unrelated to either the spouses, and that's With regards to egg donation, so someone wants to give eggs, let's say a woman wants to donate eggs to an infertile couple. There are many also over here. There's many halachic challenges, and there are many who outright prohibit it. There's a very well known posek. Halachic authority in Israel, Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, very big halachic authority in these matters and many medical matters in general, the son-in-law of Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and he allows one to be an egg donor, provided that the donor is a single Jewish woman. Well, we're talking about Jewish people here anyway, but as long as she's a single woman, and it's done with great supervision and with a registration system in a way that there will never be a possibility that right now she's a young girl, she's giving an egg, and later on she gets married, and her offspring would somehow they would somehow marry each other. Now, having discussed these, is there any questions?
Say that the case where the offspring needs a conversion, at what point?
Okay.
Okay.
The question is, why are we doing the conversion? Is it a conversion because you want to be sure, or is it a conversion because let's say that there's a surrogate mother, and we say most opinions hold that it's the mother who gives birth to the child is the determining factor. So let's say that the surrogate mother is not Jewish, and she gives birth to a child, where according to everyone the child would have to undergo conversion. So then the child would undergo conversion. We would undergo conversion after the child was born. That's when it would have to be done. We discussed last week, when we spoke about the mikveh, we spoke different things of why conversion. Let's say that there's a woman who is, let's say the surrogate herself wants to convert. Can she convert? She wants to convert while she's pregnant with a child. Can she go and convert, and will that cover the child? Now, usually we discussed, usually the way that it works, a pregnant woman who converts, it covers the child, obviously. But over here, we said that there's great halakhic authorities who say that it won't cover the child. Why not? The reason being like this. We just spoke about this last week. The Talmud asks the question, when it says, the Talmud says that we know that when a Jewish woman who's pregnant, when a woman who's pregnant converts, so the child is also covered. The Talmud asks the question, and the question is when a person goes to the mikveh, there has to be no interruption, no chatzitza, between them and the mikveh waters. So the Talmud says, well, this child is inside the mother's womb, and the child, we're talking about a normal case, the non-Jewish woman is converting. The child is totally, there's a huge chatzitza, there's a huge barrier between the child and the water. So how can you say that there's a conversion? And the answer of the Talmud is, because the child is part and parcel of the mother's body, because the child comes from the mother, these are the words of the Talmud, so therefore, the child is just, what the Talmud says, yerech imo, it's only a extension, it's only the thigh of the mother. So just as the woman goes to the mikveh and her thigh goes in, so the child also goes in. It's part of the body. So therefore, these rabbis come along and say, well, in the case of a surrogacy, well, maybe she's not really part of the body over here. Maybe she's like, this woman would be seen as just being a caretaker, or someone who's looking after someone else's child, these are their words, and it's a caretaker, or someone looking after someone else's child, a nursing mother, someone who's taking care of another child, goes to the mikveh, would that cover that child, the other child? Of course it would. They say it's unclear, therefore the conversion can only be done afterwards. Definitely, according to all opinions, by the surrogate mother going to the mikveh, which I thought of this question, I didn't see it anywhere, but it doesn't make sense to say that the surrogate mother, for her to go to the mikveh, and she doesn't want to convert that it should cover the child inside. No, that definitely logically...
She would still be Jewish, and when she had the child would come out not Jewish.
Right, exactly. Because the time of birth determines. It wouldn't cover anyway. Mm. Right. From all sides, it wouldn't cover. Both from the mikveh side, and also from when the child comes out, the child is not Jewish. Right.
Another question, is the conversion a passive thing?
For the child, yes. For the child. The way that it works for a child who's converted, so it's a major discussion in the Talmud, it says that a child is converted and what's called matbil noisa al dat bestin, which means that he is converted with the bestin's intentions, with their mind. And technically speaking, the child has the choice at the age of 12 or girl or 13 or right before the bar mitzvah to say that I don't want this religion, I'm not interested. Technically speaking, today it's not really done that way. It's more complex than that. The child has to actually protest and say I'm not interested in that. But that's in general how conversion for young children works.
So if it's a boy, he still has his bris.
Definitely has the bris. Yeah, yeah. They'll probably do the bris afterwards. Or what they do, they may do the bris, and they probably wait to do the bris. That's why a lot of the rabbis, because of all these complex issues, a lot of them just keep away from it. But as I said, they do, because they don't want to say, because then it looks like they ruled a certain way, and then anything which they're going to say, all the other rabbis are going to jump on them and say, listen, look how lenient you are, you can't be lenient like that. But of course, in extreme situations, they really try to, a good rabbi, or an expert in this field, would definitely try to help as much as possible and would explore every single avenue. For a rabbi to come along and just say, well, egg donors is out, like that. I mean, he's not putting himself into any, he's not going to get into any fights with any rabbis, but he's not doing his job. His job is to try and help the people who need the help, especially in people who are desperate in those situations. Now, having discussed the artificial insemination, IVF, donor eggs, and surrogacy, and all that comes along with it, we want to discuss a connected area of technology, which is called today PGD, is the name that it goes by, which means pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And what it is as follows. Huh? So it's all different of all things, IVF and IUI and all kinds of things. A person has half of their genetic identity from the father and half of it from their mother. That's how the human being is made up. A person who carries a genetic abnormality within his or her DNA, but is not affected, is called a carrier. This person just carries it. In there are different kinds of things. There are recessive genetic disorders, such as Pesachs and things like that, where a child will only be ill if, God forbid, if both of the parents are carriers of that abnormal gene. If only one, then the child won't cannot get that. In some cases, these disorders are passed on by affected parents to all their children, which is that's an extreme case, but there are different genetic things, which is more of a dominant kind, and that is passed on to all the children. Until recently, a couple in such a situation had very limited options. Now, what was done, usually, well, I'm talking already, we'll discuss this at another time as well, the idea of premarital screening, which is done today in frum circles, in Orthodox circles, the Dori Shorim, where they check couples, and there's a whole bunch of different things, I don't know the names of them, there's all bunch of things which they check for, and if the couple is found to have certain, that they both carry a certain gene, where there's the possibility, we're not saying 100%, but the possibility that they may have children with certain illnesses, then they advise them, they say, well, we say that you have this chance, and don't marry, and definitely this system, which we'll talk of at another time at length, the system has definitely worked very, very well in combating and almost cutting out a lot of these genetic diseases, Tay-Sachs and a lot of these things. And all the rabbis came out at the time, well, at the time, not everyone, but now you'll hardly find a rabbi who will be against it. And in fact, almost all rabbis absolutely encourage that a person, that the people in those situations, people should be screened before meeting, before marrying, so that you won't have such a thing come about. The other thing which people could have done until now, until very recently, was that they could do prenatal testing, which means that the woman is already pregnant. They'll test and they'll check. There's different ways to test to check the child, and if the child is going to be sick, going to be ill of a certain thing, so then there was, of course, the option of aborting the child, which that itself very, very complicated halachically. It depends where the child is, where the child is up to, where the mother is up to the pregnancy, and so on. With this idea of PGD, with pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, we'll just call it PGD for now, it's a bit long to say, there's a much better solution. And what's the better solution? The way it works is that the couple undergoes normal IVF, which means that the sperm is taken from the husband, eggs are taken taken out of the woman, and fertilized in a laboratory and allowed to grow for a few days. So now, up until now, it's a normal stage like normal IVF. However, before the fertilized eggs are reintroduced or placed back into the mother, one or more cells, a few cells, are removed from the egg, and they are now tested. The DNA of those cells can tell if the specific egg has characteristics which they are trying to find. If the cells say that there is a certain sickness over here, there's a certain illness which they want to keep away from, so then they'll discard that egg. They'll say they won't use it. If it's clear, then they will continue to re-implant that egg, the fertilized egg now, into the mother's womb, and the pregnancy will continue as usual. Today, this technology, most fascinating, incredible technology, can be used as a tool to identify thousands of characteristics, many, many things. As long as the DNA marker is known for a specific characteristic, and of course they're coming up with these things every single day, being able to determine different markers, different things within the DNA, what can be done is that they can check, and they could research, and they could check if the child will have a certain things. So therefore, in addition to the way our PGD, how this technology can be used to prevent genetic illnesses, it can also be used for a number of things, which, like determining the gender of the child, eye color, which is already today, and many, many other things which already can be done today. And of course, every single day, there's more and more of these DNA characteristic markers which are being found. So eventually, there will definitely be a time where they can almost produce a perfect child. Right, you can get the child who's an athlete, who's clever, who is everything.
That's only if these number of eggs you've got fertilized have got those positive.
Right, but you're picking out, you're throwing out, whatever. It will take a long time, but technically speaking, you can do that, right? There are, of course, things for which this PGD will not work, right? Such as, like we said before, if the parents are carrying a gene where all their children would be affected, so then it's not going to help. Not going to help to take the egg. Of course, I also saw that there's someone told me that there is also a situation. I'm not sure the medical term for it, but there's something where they could check the cells, and the cells would be different to other cells which would be in the egg which they're going to implant. So just by checking the cells, and the cells, these cells would say that there's no problem, whereas the egg itself, the rest of the cells of the egg could be problematic. So therefore, this PGD thing is not 100% accurate. It's 99% accurate, and they're very, very good at it, but it's not 100% accurate, and therefore someone could go along and, let's say, want to have a boy and still have a girl. It's not, but most of those mistakes are definitely human error. When it comes to genetics, they can make that small mistake, because testing the cells and the cells in the fertilized egg which is being implanted could be different. Sorry?
So therefore something like Down syndrome might only appear in 80% of cells, not in 100% of cells.
I'm not sure exactly how it works, which illnesses exactly that. But I just know that there is a thing that it's not 100%, even all the things which they know today, it's not 100%, it doesn't work with 100% of them. This kind of technology obviously raises many different issues, along with many ethical issues, many moral issues. Should we be playing God? Should we go down that avenue? Tonight I'd just like to talk a little bit about PGD in the context of choosing or selecting the gender, the sex of the child, which has been called, I saw I googled this, an American Medical Association journal, they say, this is the issue that is quickly becoming the most controversial in high-tech reproduction. The idea of selecting, of pre-gender selection, people want to, and it's very, very expensive. Costs between $10,000 and $20,000, depends where you are. But definitely people have the money, and people want to go for it, and people are interested in it. And here comes the question is, halachically, how is it dealt with? So choosing the gender of a child has to be broken down into two categories. There is for medical purposes, and there's for non-medical purposes. And halacha looks at these two different categories. For medical purposes means if one of the parents is a carrier of a disease that only affects a certain gender, such as which the Talmud already talks about, says that being hemophilic, the mothers can carry it, but only boys will have it. Only males will have it. So then gender selection would be called for medical purposes, right? The parents don't want to have a child who's sick. They don't want to, so therefore what they do is they want to have only girls. That's one kind of thing. If, however, the couple desire a baby of a specific gender for just religious purposes, for convenient purposes, for cultural purposes, and all these different purposes which are used in different places throughout the world, it would be called gender selection for a non-medical purpose. Now, I mention religious because religious is important in Judaism as well, and we'll have to see how it goes. Why? Because, I don't know if we're going to get there tonight, but in halacha, there's the very first mitzvah of the Torah is pru-ruvu, to have children. How many children? Now, Shulchan Aruch says very clearly, a person has to have a boy and a girl. If you have 100 boys, you don't fulfill your chiyuv. You don't fulfill the obligation. A person has to have a boy and a girl. The reason being is because a couple have to replace themselves. Therefore, they have to have a boy and a girl in the world. There is opinion in the Gemara. It's not the opinion in halacha. It's not brought in halacha that actually a couple have to have two boys and two girls. That's not the halacha. But a couple of people have to have a boy and a girl. And the question is over here, can we use this technology? Does halacha want us to, first of all, does it want us to use the technology? Let's say people have 10 boys. They want to have a girl now. The guy wants to fulfill his chiyuv already. He doesn't want to have more children. But he wants to fulfill his obligation. So the question is, can he use this? First of all, is he allowed to? Does he have to? Or is he not allowed to at all? Using this kind of technology. That's why I say for religious purposes, we'll address that issue on its own. We'll get there next week. Let's look at it for the purpose of medical purposes. So using this PGD, pre-implantation genetic diagnosis system, for purposes which are totally medical. Now, what could be the issues? Most of the issues we've already actually discussed, as you'll see. First of all, since PGD, what it does, it involves the use of only the good eggs. So what would actually happen is that if you find that an egg is no good, you'd have to, what they do is that they discard the egg, they throw out the egg. Are you allowed to just discard the egg, throw out the egg? That would be a halachic question. When discussing the issue with regards to general IVF, where the way that IVF works is in a way a similar thing, because what they usually do is that they remove more eggs than are actually needed in order to increase the chances. They will remove many eggs, and comes up the question of, can we discard, what do we do with those extra eggs? What should be done with them? And we spoke about that. We explained that halachically there's a difference between a potential life and a potential embryo. Right? A potential life, which means the child, the potential child in the uterus, may not be aborted, in general, because if left alone in the uterus, that fetus will develop to be a full-fledged child, a human being. Therefore, we say that if you're going to intervene over there, you're actually, by you intervening, you're killing the child. You're stopping something. Whereas over here, when the embryo or the fertilized egg is outside of the uterus, it's not in a place where if you leave it alone, it's going to continue to survive. It's not going to continue to survive. It's actually going to die. It's not die because it's not alive. But it's, therefore, there's a very big halakhic difference, and these eggs may be discarded. They can be thrown away. And we did see one opinion, which we mentioned before, the opinion of Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu, who passed away last year. He was a great rabbi who ruled on these matters, and he helped many, many people in these matters. A lot of his rulings are used by a number of Orthodox institutes today. And he ruled, in fact, with regards to this, rather he said, don't actually discard it, but let it die on its own, meaning don't put in the different hormones, whatever they do, whatever they add, to let this fertilized egg in the laboratory be able to continue living. But so in this particular situation, the question of what to do with those non-good eggs, is it alive? It's not alive. Because it's not alive, there's no problem with discarding those eggs. So that's not an issue. What about interference with nature? Is it permissible? Is this called interfering with nature? We're talking about it for a real medical purpose. Remember, we're not talking about an elective purpose. We're talking about when it's for a real medical purpose. So we definitely discussed this one as well. We explained that the same way, and this is the way the rabbis put it, the same way that you wouldn't tell a sick person that, hey, why are you going to the doctor? I mean, why are you intervening in nature? Let nature have its effect. Let it carry on in the normal way. The Torah says very clearly that a doctor has a duty to heal. It's an obligation. He actually has to go and do that. So too in this case, the rabbi's right that where we are looking at to prevent an illness which could come about, the person would be considered to be a sick one, and here too we are permitted to act in a manner that would heal their illness. And therefore, this is definitely not called intervening, stopping nature. It's actually the chokhmah, the way that they describe it, the wisdom which God has given man to be able to come to do such things, to heal in such a way, and act the way that Hashem acts, being Hashem is described in the Torah as being the great doctor, and Hashem Refecha, I'm Hashem your doctor, and emulating those ways of Hashem would definitely be the way to go. We'll see that this, of course, changes. This plain God question changes when you're talking about non-elective purposes, when you want to just have a boy or a girl for other purposes which are not these medical purposes. Now, using this PGD, is clearly permitted, definitely permitted, by all major poskim, by all major halachic authorities, in these real medical situations. It's permitted to such an extent that the question is actually a different question which comes up. The question which comes up is it obligatory? If a couple knows that they have, they're both carriers of a certain gene, so the rabbis come up with a question, and this is the question discussed today, whether this couple are halakhically obliged to only have children in such a way. Right, that is the question which is brought up. So it's not whether we're not dealing with in this situation. It's not whether it's allowed. It's whether it's obligated to act in such a way. What's the issue? At the heart of the issue is the obligation which a person has. This is the way what the rabbis discuss to save another person's life. The greatest mitzvah in the Torah. A person has to put everything aside to save another person's life. Pikuach nefesh, saving a life, docha kol Torah, kula pushes away all the mitzvahs of the Torah. Now the question over here is this considered saving a life or not? Right? If it's saving a life, there's an absolute obligation. The question is it considered to be saving a life? So using this technology to prevent a child with severe genetic disorders falls into this category, definitely. The question is, how far back does this obligation to save the life of another extend? There are rabbis today who rule that the obligation, many rabbis will say, the obligation extends even to a person who is not yet alive. And therefore, and this obviously obligates, obliges the use of such technology to prevent potential life-threatening illnesses which are going to come about. Now, remember that it's not to say that a fertilized egg is a life. They're not saying that at all. But that what they're saying is that we have to do whatever we can to prevent the death of a real life. And that obligation begins even before the real life has come about. That's one opinion. There are other rabbis who maintain that our obligation to save a life does not extend to a person who's not yet alive, even though we think that such a person may be born. Doesn't mean to say that they don't recommend it. Most rabbis would recommend it. It's just to say that they cannot require it. And that's probably the prevailing opinion from looking through different writings and what they hold today, is that most rabbis are not going to obligate it, but they're going to say that it depends. Obviously, it depends on the situation. They say that it would be definitely recommended. Just when talking about non-elective, we'll finish off with this, because this is where we're up to, discussing gender selection when it's not strictly for medical purposes. I just want to mention two cases, just to show how, even though that for non-elective purposes, the rabbis are definitely strict and are not very quick to allow it, but every single situation is unique. We've been saying throughout, with the IVF, with all these different things, every single situation is unique. But so too over here, every single situation is unique. And we're talking specifically about gender selection, where it's not exactly, not only for purposes of medical purposes. I'll give you two real examples, where the rabbis allowed it, a whole team of rabbis allowed it, and you understand why. First example is as follows. There was a Kohen who could not produce sperm himself. So him and his wife, they got a halachic ruling that they were allowed to take sperm from a donor, from a Jewish donor. And we discussed this. Now the issue was, obviously, that the child would not be his son. Halachically, he's not his son at all. Everyone would think that he's his son. He wouldn't be his son. The father is a Kohen. The child's not a Kohen. The father goes up to Duchen, goes up to bless the people. The child doesn't go up to bless the people. The father gets called up the first Aliyah, and this child doesn't get called up the first Aliyah. This man, who the father, he's not real, the real father, he didn't want, first of all, he didn't want to have to explain to his son exactly that he's not actually his son. On the other hand, although at some stage he may have to do that, and besides for the obvious embarrassment to the man himself, they consulted with the rabbis. Sorry? Right, very good. Obviously, right. I think this is something, yeah, good point. The rabbis, the couple consulted the rabbis, and the rabbis allowed, they said, in this particular situation, you would be allowed to use this technology, the PGD technology, to determine that the child should be a girl, so you won't have these issues. That's what they said, and they used it, and that's a real, real situation which happened, and actually I was told by, this was brought before the whole institute, that today they have a couple of girls, not only one. We'll see that there is a little bit of a difference when a couple is already using IVF. It's not the same thing if you're already using IVF, to go and do it, to go and then select, is a little bit different than to go along and use IVF for this purpose. Right? This purpose, they had to use IVF anyway. Okay, that's put that on the side. But anyway, I'm just trying to point out that every single situation is unique. Every single situation is its own. Another example, there was a very, very depressed father, he was depressed for the following reason. In real depression, and he was seeing a psychiatrist for the problem. The problem was that he had five daughters, and he really wanted to have a son. I'm not sure, I don't know if he wanted to have a son for halachic reasons, because he wanted to fulfill the mitzvah, but he was actually at the stage that he was very, very depressed. Although psychiatric help could help this man, and definitely he was a case for that, and they were helping, the rabbis ruled that in this particular case as well, the depression was good enough to allow, to warrant, that they could use gender selection, the sixth child, and it did work, obviously, and the sixth child was born a boy. So, which I don't know what it did to his depression, took it away, it didn't take it away, but the point is that every single situation is unique. We'll discuss more next week. We'll talk about these issues and more about genetic screening and these kind of things. Any questions? Right. So I saw that in that particular case, no, I think actually I got confused. I think they might have used non-Jewish. I don't remember the details of that case. They might have used non-Jewish because the Jewish donor is more a problem of adultery and different and different issues. Right. Good point. Yeah. But at any rate, they got the child would not follow the father, would not follow the kohen, and out of embarrassment. So the idea is that they're very, very in these things, because the general idea is allowed. It's not out. It's not totally not allowed. Therefore, it depends on how beneficial it's going to be. And this embarrassment and this situation, which is a real, real situation, it definitely warranted, and the rabbis allowed it. And therefore, every single I mentioned those two cases just to point out how each situation is absolutely unique. No situation is the same, even for non-medical purposes. And we'll talk about non-medical purposes, especially about pruvu, about fulfilling the mitzvah. The question is whether the mitzvah is any way fulfilled with IVF, which we mentioned before. Which, according to most opinions, it definitely is. But there is an opinion that it's not. The question is, can you go along with this when there are strong opinions that it's not fulfilled with IVF anyway?
It's also the law of the country. Some countries have
Of course. Every country is different.
Yeah.
Right.
And with the case of the egg being a Jewish egg, and the gestational mother is not Jewish, so does the... If the egg is a Jewish donor, and the birth mother is not Jewish.
Right.
Obviously,
right, but you said that the egg donor is Jewish, right?
Yeah.
And people are using a non-Jewish surrogate.
Yeah.
Right? So then, according to all opinions, the child would need conversion.
So
because the stronger opinion is definitely that it all follows the mother. It all follows the mother who delivers, the woman who delivers the child.
But it's still preferable that the donor egg is a Jewish.
Well, but that's the opposite way around. Even according to the opinion, which says that everything is determined by the delivering mother, then even if the delivering mother is Jewish, still the egg donor should be Jewish.
Right?
Because that covers all your bases. First of all, it covers all sides. And also, remember, there is an opinion which says that it follows that the Judaism, that it's determined by the genetic mother. But there's another opinion which says that we have to rule with both of them, that they're both the mothers. And if they're both the mothers, so because of both those opinions, definitely both should be Jewish.
So if the child
would definitely need conversion. That's definite. The question is if their surrogate, meaning the mother giving birth to the child is Jewish and the other one's not Jewish, so then the question of conversion is really depends on the rabbi. As we discussed, there's this idea of conversion. Even first of all, the child may not be Jewish, according to one opinion. May not be Jewish at all, because we may say that it's all determined genetically, which there is that strong opinion. Furthermore, even if you say the child is 100% Jewish, there's that second element of conversion of the sanctity of Israel, and definitely this child didn't have that same sanctity because part of its formation was came from a non-Jew.
And in the case of the donor egg mother is not Jewish and the birth mother is not Jewish, so after the event, can the child convert?
Well, it's just like any non-Jewish person born. It's like, of course. It's just the same as any non-Jewish person born. There's no difference at all. The person can definitely. There's a very interesting question, there's so many questions which come to mind. But remember, we said the reason I was just on this topic of discarding the eggs, of discarding the fertilized eggs. The reason that they say that it's different to abortion is because the halachic reason is because in abortion. Well, if the child would be left alone, the child would continue to grow. Whereas over here, if the child would be left alone, so then the child would be, if the fertilized egg would be left alone, it would die. So therefore, you're not actually stopping anything. But you actually, the whole time, putting in these different things, you're actually sustaining it. So you're just stopping to sustain it, but you're not actually killing it. You're not stopping its life. So the question comes up, what will be... And I mentioned this in another context, but what will be... Right. We spoke about that. Exactly. We spoke about Shabbos and Yontif, that you wouldn't be allowed to desecrate Shabbos in order to save fertilized eggs either. Right? So if there's fertilized eggs in a laboratory and the electricity goes off and you want to save the incubator or whatever they use, so then we said, you also, on the other hand, you wouldn't be allowed to do it because you're not only allowed to desecrate Shabbos to save a real life or to save a fetus, but not for that purpose. Yeah, we mentioned that. But the question which comes up is like this. What will be, if there'll be a time where they could take sperm and egg from man and woman, put it into a incubator, and then that incubator will produce a child. So then will we say that abortion will be allowed then at any stage? Because you, by switching on the incubator and providing all the hormones or all the artificial thing, you are sustaining it. Without sustaining it, it will stop. Right? Or would we say, well, that's a little bit different. You see? But using that same reasoning as before, we'd be allowed to do abortion at any stage. Right? Also, the question of the child being Jewish or not Jewish. That I mentioned before. I mentioned it with regard to that context, but now I'm mentioning it with regard to abortion. Because if...
You would have a son.
Right, so that's the question of... the question is, the truth is, your question of whether the child's human or not, because there's rabbis who write about this, and they talk about, they ask, does this child have the law of a golem? A golem, the golem of Prague, who didn't have the law of a... of who the rabbis discussed the golem.
The gestation that the child studies with the angels and things, and it's not gestation.
Right. Is this gestation? Is it not? That's the whole question. There's a rabbi who wrote an article on this whole thing of all different questions which could come about through this. If this would one day come about, this idea of a child being, I don't know, 5 years, but but it's very rapidly advancing. No. That's a very interesting question. No, the question with the golem. I mentioned something quite interesting. The golem is a topic which inspired a lot of halachic writings. So the golem, the man created by another man. Now, the golem wasn't the first one to be created by another man. The golem was also, the Gemara talks about, it says that Rav Huna and Rabbo, they used to get together on a Friday afternoon, and they used to practice practical Kabbalah, Sefer Yetzirah. And they used to create people. It says once they used to create a calf to eat. And they used to create a man. It says Rabbi Zaira once made a man. The whole story in the Talmud of these different things. And the question which is brought up already in old texts, we're talking about 400 or 500 years ago, is whether, first of all, does the golem count? Did the golem count for a minion? If someone kills the golem, are they called a murderer or not? Now they point out the two words in the Torah, and the words in the Torah are like this. Torah says when Hashem said to Noach, he said, Shofech dam ha'odom ba'odom dam ha'ishofech. And we brought those words once before over here. someone who spills the blood of a man in a man. His blood should be spilled. What does it mean to spill the blood of man in a man? Look at it. Those are the words of the Torah. There's all different commentaries. But one of the ideas is, blood of a man has to be a man who was produced in a man. But if it's a man who is produced, not from in a man, by another man, then it doesn't cover that at all. I'll finish off with one beautiful proof, which has to do with this week. There's a proof to say that the golem doesn't count for a minion. The proof is as follows. Or a man created by another man. Just hold with me for a minute, we'll go through it. The Talmud says that in a number of places, it says that the Zutra de Bechu Mechaya Mason, which means that the smallest person mentioned in the Talmud was able to do Tchiyat HaMeisim, was able to revive the dead. It was like nothing for them to revive the dead. There's many stories in the Talmud when they did it, but they created people, they revived the dead. There's a famous story in the Talmud which says that once people got together to daven, and there was no minion. So Rabbi Lezer was there. Rabbi Lezer was not just any man in the Talmud, he was a great man of the Mishnah. And he says Rabbi Lezer had his slave with him. Rabbi Lezer shichrer abdur. Rabbi Lezer released his slave to go and make up the minion. He released his slave to be part of the minion, because a slave doesn't count for a minion, but as soon as he's released, he counts for the minion. The Gemara asks a question, a very strong question. The Gemara says, the mitzvah is that if a person has a slave who is a non-Jewish slave, who obviously this man was because he didn't count for the minion, the Torah says, lo'olam behem ta'avodu, which means that a person is that non-Jewish slave should be your slave forever. You're not allowed to release a non-Jewish slave. The question is, how did Rabbi Lezer release his non-Jewish slave in order to perform this mitzvah of a minion? Right? And actually, the commentaries talk about it. So what do you mean a mitzvah of a minion? A minion is only derabbanan anyway. To daven with a minion is only rabbinic. How did he put aside this mitzvah deraisa of releasing a slave in order to make up the minion? So some of the commentaries say, and this is why I'm connected with this week's Pasha, is that it was actually talking about Shabbos Zohar, where there's one time in the year where we have to hear the Torah, you have to have a minion, and therefore they were there Shabbos Zohar. They only had 9 people. Rabbi Lezer released his slave to make up the minion, and the Torah and the Gemara goes on and on how he released his slave and whether it's a minion and all different kind of things. So comes the Chacham Tzvi, lived there a couple of hundred years ago, and he says, this is the proof that a golem doesn't count for a minion. Why? Why would Rabbi Lezer have to release his slave and get into all these halachic problems? Let him just create a man, and the man will count for the minion, and then he has his minion. Says Chacham Tzvi, from there's the proof that a golem doesn't count for a minion. It's an interesting proof, but that's his way of thinking. Anyway.